This is not a movie. And the doomsday device is real.
Enough of burning and drilling and mining our way deeper. We are digging our own graves.
Those of us who are responsible for much of the deforestation and all the problems we have so far have an overwhelming obligation to the nations who, in fact, were not there, have not done it.
It should be obvious that we cannot solve a crisis with the same methods that got us into it in the first place.
When will we, as world leaders across the world, address the pressing issues that are truly causing our people angst and worry, whether it is climate or whether it is vaccines? Simply put, when will leaders lead?
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Today is the final day of the COP26 UN Climate Change Conference, and diplomats from all over the world are scrambling to piece together an agreement to show for their time in Glasgow. Maybe by the time you're listening to this, they have announced a deal. But regardless of the conclusion of COP26, what we're interested in today is whether these types of international agreements actually shape countries' climate policies. After all, the leaders at the conference have their own domestic politics to consider and citizens back home to answer to. So what are the most important factors in determining how nations respond to climate change? And what do the people back home want? We'll look at this from two perspectives. First, we'll look at the global politics of cutting carbon emissions and the history of international agreements. Then, we'll focus on domestic perceptions of climate change, both here in the United States and abroad. Here with us to kick things off is political science professor at the University of Melbourne, Robin Eckersley. Her research focuses on global environmental politics and international relations. Welcome to the show, Robin.
It's a pleasure.
At the moment that we're speaking, diplomats are in their final stretch of negotiations. What kind of agreement are they working towards, and what are the main sticking points?
There are three main things on the agenda from the point of view of the British hosts. First, to ramp up ambition, all countries have put pledges in. They're formally called nationally determined contributions, and they run to 2030. But they've waved a ruler over this, and they're way below what is needed to hold warming between 1.5 and 2 degrees, way below. And this is a critical decade. So the idea is to ramp up mitigation ambition for the pledges that were made in the year leading up to the Paris negotiations. And at that point, most parties didn't even know what legal form it would take. So they probably aimed fairly low. So these have to be ramped up. Secondly, climate finance. Back in 2009, the parties made a promise to mobilise $100 billion annually by 2020 to provide finance to developing countries to assist them with mitigation and adaptation. And to do otherwise is just to kick the ladder down, because they're not as responsible for historical emissions, they're more vulnerable, and they don't have the same capacity as developed countries. That's below par. It's going into the conference that was about $20 billion short. And then there's a whole lot of rule book issues, particularly negotiations on international carbon markets that haven't been completed and are very, very contentious. So they're the big ticket items, but there's a lot more, but they're kind of, that's like the main game.
It sounds like in the list that you've laid out, there are various tensions at play. To what extent do these kinds of agreements actually matter in determining the domestic policies of each nation or pressuring nations to do more?
Well, that's an excellent question. And there's not a lot of research that explains why some countries are more easily shamed by not performing their international legal commitments than others. And it's really interesting why that's the case. It has to do with not just their national identity, but their sense of their role in the world. So, for example, Germany and Scandinavian countries, they really want to live up to the commitments they make. Russia can't be shamed, for example. At the moment, my own country is utterly shameless. So that's an interesting question. So there's a lot of research on what makes a leader and what makes a laggard in terms of national performance. And the answer is typically it's fossil fuel stupid, the degree of heavy dependence on fossil fuels. But that doesn't explain everything, because if you do comparative studies between countries that have heavy fossil fuel dependency, like Norway and Australia, you'll still find that Norway cares more about its reputation than Australia. And I've done research on that very question, and the same comparing Australia to Germany. That said, most states conform with most treaties most of the time. And I would say that what's difficult about the Paris Agreement is that the national pledges are kind of really flexible and there's no compliance mechanisms if you don't get there. So it really just depends on the honour of a state as to whether they're going to take that seriously. It is a legally binding treaty within the meaning of the Vienna Convention, but back in Paris, they cut the Gordian knot, which was the huge disagreement between developed and developing countries, and particularly US, China and India, by simply giving national flexibility. And so that was the price of success of Paris, and now we're seeing the cost of that in the sense that some countries think, nah, I don't really need to do much about this because nothing's going to flow other than a bit of shaming. But believe me, there's a lot of shaming at the COP, not necessarily amongst the negotiators because they're conforming with diplomatic protocols, but on the side events, in the streets and in the media, and they feel it.
So you mentioned that one of the key determining factors of how aggressive a country is in pursuing carbon emissions cuts is how dependent that nation is on fossil fuels. What are the other determining factors in terms of how a nation sets its emissions or climate policy? What are the pressure points? Is it public opinion, you know, the businesses housed within that country, its neighbors, international pressure?
Well, scholars of comparative climate policy who like to be parsimonious say it's a function of relative fossil fuel dependence, which is the costs of transition as effectively, versus relative vulnerability, where you would be concerned about the future of your country because of the impacts of climate change that are already with us. And we saw this with the Black Summer fires in Australia in 2019, 2020, which covered an area bigger than the United Kingdom, almost as big as Turkey. And yet we don't seem to be bothered by that huge vulnerability that our continent is at. So it also has to do with political institutions, the distribution of electorates. It also has to do with the nature of party competition. So, for example, if you've got a political system where you've got quite a large number of political parties, a proportional representation voting system, which means that parties have to learn to get on with other parties on either side of their flank to form a coalition government, you don't get the same degree of polarisation and nastiness than you get in the Anglosphere countries like the US and Australia, where you have a dominant two-party system and a distribution of votes that favours regional electorates or small states, which may be dependent on fossil fuel and therefore have a disproportionate vote in the Senate. So you have political economy factors mediated by political institutions. And then, of course, on top of that is the nature of the media, whether the legacy media is strong, respected, and how much social media is doing damage or doing good in terms of educating the public about what's at stake.
When we look at international agreements historically, whether on climate or on other things like nuclear proliferation, how often do countries actually comply with the agreements that they make?
Well, as I said, most states do comply with most treaties most of the time, across the board. But of course, great powers have this exceptionalism. And they cannot comply because they can, because they can get away with it in a way that smaller states, middle powers and smaller states can't. Think of, for example, China's building of military installations on reefs in the South China Sea. Now, China was a party to negotiating the International Convention on the Law of the Sea, which gives you all the rules of how you draw your territorial sea and your exclusive economic zone. And what it's doing is totally contrary to that, and it's a party. And it's been taken to The Hague, and there's been a ruling against it brought by Philippines, but it's totally ignoring it, and Philippines is powerless to do anything about it. So that's one example, and there's plenty on America's side of the fence too. And there are other states that sometimes flout international law. But when it comes to environmental law, we tend to find, unlike, say, trade law, there aren't sanctions, there's no court system. It's not a very legalized system. It relies on voluntary support and encouragement rather than sanctions. And that's because the majority of states are developing countries and because they need help and assistance in addressing environmental problems. So it's a different type of problem. It's a shared fate problem. And it's really important to have open lines of diplomatic channels and also funds, multilateral funds that assist developing countries. So it's a kind of different atmosphere to something like trade negotiations.
Is it clear at this point whether or not countries are complying with the carbon emission cuts goals that they've set?
Well, it's too soon to tell. And as I said, there are no compliance mechanisms. All we have is a transparency framework. So it's like a show and tell regime where each country, they've chosen, they're allowed to determine their 2030 target, and every 5 years later they have to have another one to 2035 and so forth. And they are required under the treaty to ramp up their ambition with each cycle, but we're still in the first cycle. And when you add up all the pledges, initially we're looking at a really hot world of about, 2.7 degrees. With the enhanced ambition that we've seen so far, with the effort by the host to really get parties to ramp up their initial pledge, it's been brought down to about 2.4, if you just focus on the 2030 pledges, not 2050. So we've shaved off some degrees, as it were, but to put it really plainly, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says that global emissions have to fall by at least 45% by 2030 to give us a 50-50 chance of holding warming to 1.5 degrees by the end of the century. And that's still relying on some carbon dioxide drawdown. Now, that means that rich countries have to reduce emissions much harder than poor countries to give them some slack. We're nowhere near that. And that's only a 50-50 chance. So at the moment, 1.5 degrees is almost out of reach.
And of course, that 1.5 degrees Celsius is the limit that climate science suggests would avoid catastrophe.
That's right.
So I guess my question is here, what's the point of this kind of conference if it seems like everything is voluntary, and even if you don't stick to your voluntary pledge, there's no enforcement mechanism anyway?
Well, if we wind it back to 2015, the parties had the choice to stay in a kind of Groundhog Day moment because of deep divisions amongst the negotiating blocs. And it's been going round and round in circles ever since 2007, when they started to produce a new treaty that China and America would be part of. Because at that moment, they weren't part of the Kyoto Protocol. And so Paris was a huge diplomatic success relative to the alternative of no agreement. And we're definitely better off with that agreement than without. But the price of getting everyone on board was to provide this flexibility. So when you compare it against the counterfactual of no agreement, we're way ahead. When you compare it to the distance from the collective optimum, we're nowhere close. So this is the tragic nature of international climate politics.
For people who say that the world isn't doing enough to cut emissions and it isn't on track to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, are there, in the political theory realm of things, ideas for what kind of incentive structures might work?
Well, clearly, the massive drop in the cost of renewable energy around the world has now changed the narrative for many countries and many companies. Whereas the single-minded focus in many countries is what is the short-term cost of action? And people concerned about the climate say, what's the long-term cost of not acting and what are the co-benefits of acting now? Put all the cards on the table facing up. And when you do that, it starts to become a more rational decision. And so a lot of people are now seeing climate action not as a cost but as a new opportunity. And not only that, if you think of a world where most countries are powered by renewable energy and a lot of that is locally developed, think of the role of fossil fuels in geopolitics. It's going to change geopolitics.
And I mean, that sounds kind of a reason to want to pursue it, but leaders are very much responsive to the political needs of their constituencies in this very moment. You know, climate change is, while it's increased in terms of the number of people who say that it's a crisis, it's very rarely near the top of the list in terms of people's priorities. Oftentimes, there's one crisis after another that even if climate change was really important to domestic politics, it keeps getting eclipsed by either COVID or inflation or what have you. So in that world, how do you create an incentive structure for cutting carbon emissions to become more important, to become so politically salient that domestic leaders actually pursue carbon cuts more aggressively?
Now, that's a good question because in our research field, we say that environmental problems, including climate change, they're a valence issue, but not a salience issue. Like everyone agrees we need to do something, more or less, but it's not top of the hits when it comes to your immediate everyday concerns. And so politicians will respond in democracies that are working and not deeply distorted. They will respond to changing opinion in the electorate. But what this requires, it requires us to use our imagination. Those of us that have experienced extreme climate impacts don't need to use our imagination, but we tend to forget. We would have thought that Hurricane Katrina or Sandy would leave this after effect, but researchers after disaster show that there's only a narrow window where you can do transformative change and then people forget and it goes away. And funnily enough, in all the countries that have experienced major climate impacts, that transformative opportunity is very tiny for countries that are very heavily dependent on fossil fuels. So I think this is where you do need leadership by politicians to take the problem to the community, explain it, and also match the problem, the scale of the problem that you narrate with the solutions that you have. If they're deeply out of sync, it's not credible. So that's the challenge. And most importantly, I think you need to put yourself in the position of those communities that feel they're being left behind. Don't call them deplorables. Totally go to them with understanding. And most importantly, you want leaders from within those communities to do that work. People parachuting from outside, they're not part of that community. I know that because I grew up in a rural community and I know how they work. So it's really, really important that there be a just transition planned and anticipated from the ground up in the community with government support. And so we're having this here in the Latrobe Valley, which is our big coal producing region in our state of Victoria. It's several hours out of Melbourne, big regional dependent community. We've just closed down one power station, another one's to come. There's a huge effort now. We've set up a transition authority. So, for example, in Spain, they've got the Ministry for Ecological Transition. They've got one in France. They have one in Germany. It was just the Coal Commission. It wasn't a broad one. But the International Labour Organization has principles of just transition, and it looks after not just workers but dependent communities. So you need regional economic development plans for the affected communities. You need to get in there early before the coal stations leave, so they've already got something to start moving across to. And it's visible and understandable and palpable in the communities affected. That, to me, seems the best way of dealing with the politics of opposition, is to recognise it as early as possible and deal with it rather than pretend it's not there, because then you'll get a huge backlash.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. Thanks so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Galen. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Robin Eckersley, political science professor at the University of Melbourne. Up next, we're going to focus on public perceptions of climate change here in the U.S. and abroad. But first...
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
The extent to which conferences like COP26 can shape domestic policies or put pressure on nations to act is far from absolute. Domestic politics matter a lot. And so for the rest of today's show, that's what we're going to focus on: the politics and perceptions of climate change in the U.S. and abroad. And here with me to do that is Anthony Leiserwitz. He's the director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. His research focuses on the public's climate change beliefs and policy preferences and the factors that shape those. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thanks, Galen. It's great to be with you.
Let's start from a global perspective. How much knowledge is there about climate change globally, and what are the perceptions of it to the extent that there is knowledge about it?
Yeah, great question. So let me take us back about 10 years when we partnered with the Gallup World Poll to do what is still the first and most extensive scientific study of public understanding of this issue in about 130 countries around the world. And what we found back then were a couple critical factors. One, 4 out of 10 adults on planet Earth had never heard of climate change. That's almost 2 billion people. And that increased to 2/3 or even 3/4 of the population in particularly vulnerable countries like, say, India or Egypt or Bangladesh, which is often upheld as a poster child of climate vulnerability, and yet 2/3 of Bangladeshis had never heard of it. But what we also found was that that didn't mean that people are unaware of changes to their local climates. Many of these people absolutely are conscious that temperatures are changing, rainfall patterns are shifting, growing seasons are changing, because in many cases, their lives literally depend on these climate conditions. But what they lack is the concept of climate change to make sense of those changes, and even more importantly, the concept of climate change to inform their future decisions. These are societies that are making huge bets about the future. Where are we going to build all these new cities that are going to house millions and millions of people? Where are we going to site our roads and our bridges and our schools and our hospitals? What crops are we going to grow in our country? These are huge bets. And of course, human beings tend to assume that the future will look like the past. But if there's one thing we know about climate, is that the future absolutely will not look like the past. So we still think job one is that there's still a huge need to raise basic awareness among many other people around the world, especially in the developing world. We just recently done a study in 31 countries and territories, so not quite as big as the one 10 years ago. And I think things have gotten better, but we still think there's at least 1 billion people across the planet who still have never heard of this issue.
I'm curious from a polling perspective, since that's something that we focus on a lot on this podcast and at 538, how you get a sense of that many people across different kinds of countries where they may not be democracies. Some countries don't even really allow pollsters in to talk to their citizens. What is it like trying to poll the globe as opposed to countries that have liberal democracies where there's election polling done on a regular basis?
Yeah, great question. And let's just say it's complicated because obviously societies are very different. So let's take the Gallup study as an example. Different methods were used that were appropriate for different countries. So here in the United States, it was appropriate to use telephone surveys. But you can't do that in a country like, say, Nigeria, where many people just, certainly at the time, did not have telephones. So those are traditional face-to-face, you know, stratified sample, geographic sample kind of work. So basically, the point is that you just need to use the most appropriate methods that for each individual country's circumstances. I will also point out that there are certain countries that you just can't do studies in. Like, I'm not aware that anybody has ever done a representative survey of any kind in North Korea, for example. So, you know, there are some parts of the world that you just cannot do surveys in.
China is, of course, the world's largest emitter currently. And I've looked into United Nations polling. They did the largest poll ever, I think, on climate. It was 1.2 million people. They didn't include China. What are perceptions within China about climate change?
So we've done a couple studies actually in China. And by the way, I think you're referring to the UN Development Program study, which has serious methodological questions about it. So
I thought so too. They used mobile phone games in order to contact people, which you would imagine is a very slim subsection of the world.
Don't get me started. So anyway, what do the Chinese think? So the Chinese are in some ways more advanced or farther along in accepting the reality and the seriousness of climate change than Americans. But in other ways, they're not that different. So basically, we found that the Chinese overall are more convinced that climate change is happening and human caused than Americans are. But they didn't really see it as any greater of a risk than Americans did, which was kind of surprising. And then you get to really interesting things about differences in the countries about who they expect to take action, who should be leading action. In the United States, Americans overwhelmingly say it should be companies. The private sector should be leading the way, followed by consumers, and then comes the government. But in China, you kind of see the opposite. There, it's all about the government is really the ones that should be taking action, and businesses and private individuals are well after that. So, you know, as they say in China, it's big government, small people, whereas in the U.S., we tend to focus on individuals as opposed to the government.
Taken as a whole, how urgent do people believe climate change is, and how willing are people to make changes in their lives to deal with it?
So again, complicated depending on where you're asking. So again, you got to factor out the fact that there's still a lot of people on Earth who've never heard of climate change. But of those that have heard of climate change, we know that most are actually very concerned about it. And that's true across the world. But here we kind of see an inverted relationship. So as before, in terms of just basic awareness, it's very high in the developed world, in the rich countries, but much lower in the developing world, where in some cases people still lack even basic literacy. So it's kind of hard to participate in climate change discourse if you don't even know how to read and write yet. But we see the inverted pattern around risk perceptions. So in other words, people in the South, in the global South, those developing countries who are aware of climate change are typically very, very worried about it because they recognize just how vulnerable their societies are. Whereas people in, say, the wealthier countries like Europe and the United States, Australia, and so on, tend not to see it as much of a risk. And this really jives with a longer term pattern we've seen in the United States, is that many people still think of climate change as a distant problem, distant in time, that the impacts won't be felt for a generation or more, or distant in space. This is about polar bears, or maybe some developing countries, but not the United States, not my state, not my community, not my friends, not my family, not me. And so as a result, for many people, it's still kind of psychologically distant, just becomes one of 100 other issues that's out there, but not yet seeing why this is so critical and why it's so important. Last thing to say, though, is that perception is changing and has changed pretty substantially over the past 5 years as Americans are increasingly suffering from being harmed by this spate of just record-setting extreme events. And 2021, of course, has been a really brutal year. And we're just now seeing that in our latest polling results here in the United States.
How closely tied in your examination of this issue is public opinion to the behavior of political leaders across the world on climate change?
Sure. So a dictatorship is a very different place than a democracy and so on. And of course, what is the underlying political economy of those countries? If you're a country that has a very strong fossil fuel industry, it's a very different political environment than, say, a country where you don't have a strong opposition in that sense. So it does matter where you're talking about. But I'd say as a broad point, one, I think people tend generally to get too focused on like majorities of public opinion support X policy or Y policy or X politician or so on. That's, I would call that necessary but insufficient. Basically, that's telling elected officials that they have permission, often silent permission, from their constituents to take action. So in other words, they won't be punished if you've got a clear majority of people who support a particular policy, let's say. But that's very different than what I think is really critical, and that is a powerful, what's called an issue public, a small set of citizens who are deeply, deeply devoted to a particular issue. And of course, we know issue publics in the United States all the time. It's the pro-choice or the anti-abortion movement. It's the pro or anti-immigration movement. It's the gun control movement versus the NRA. In fact, let's just take the NRA as a great example. The NRA is about 4 million people in a country of over 300 million. And yet they punch way above their weight numerically, politically, right? They have political muscle because they are organized as a community to make sure that their demands are absolutely being heard and that they are affecting electoral outcomes and they are letting elected officials know exactly what they think. That, I think, is really the missing piece for the climate community. And in our research, we find that there's probably about something on the order of 25 million Americans who are alarmed about climate change, willing to join such a campaign to convince elected officials to act, but nobody's ever asked them to. And so there is a potential latent issue public on climate change that is just now starting to get really organized. And that's something that we're starting to see congeal over the past few years.
You said 25 million people are maybe the most engaged on this issue. What are the different buckets that Americans fall into, the rest of the 300 million people? And how big is the bucket that would be kind of adamantly opposed to whatever kinds of policies that 25 million might pursue?
This is an analysis that we did starting 14 years ago, where we realized Americans don't have a single viewpoint about climate change or, frankly, any other important issue. And then too often people divide the public into believers and deniers. But that's way too simplistic and really not very helpful. So what we did is basically a segmentation analysis of the American people and found six Americas, what we call global warming six Americas. And very quickly, they kind of along a spectrum. So here's results from just last December. The first is a group we call the alarmed, fully convinced it's happening, human-caused, serious, urgent, strongly support action, but they don't know what to do themselves, and they don't yet know what we can do collectively. So they're really eager to get involved, but they haven't yet been organized. That's about 26% of the country, and it's been growing dramatically over the past 5 years. The next is a group we call the concerned, 29%. These are people who think it's happening, human-caused, and serious, but again, they still think of things as distant in time and space, so they feel like, yeah, I would support action, but I don't yet see why this is urgent. Then a group we call the cautious at 19%. These are people who are still on the fence. Is it real? Is it not? Is it human? Is it natural? Is it serious? Kind of overblown. They're paying attention, but are still kind of confused. Then a small, but I think important group here in the US, we call the disengaged, about 6%. These are people who say, you know, I think I once heard that term global warming, but I don't know what that is. I don't know what the causes, consequences, or solutions are. So they really, it's just basic awareness that's still the primary barrier. Then a group we call the doubtful at 12%. These are people who say, you know, I don't think it's real, but if it is, it's natural. It's just natural cycles, nothing we had anything to do with, nothing we can do anything about. So they don't really think about it that much. And then last but not least is a group we call the dismissive, 8%. Who are firmly convinced it's not happening, it's not human caused, it's not serious, and in fact, most of whom quite literally tell us they're conspiracy theorists. They say it's a hoax, it's scientists making up data, it's a UN plot to take away American sovereignty, it's a get-rich scheme by Al Gore and his friends, and many other such conspiracy-minded narratives. But importantly, they're only 8%. They're only 8%. But they're a really loud 8%. They're a really vocal 8%, and they're more than adequately represented in the halls of Congress. And they've tended to dominate the public square to such an extent that the other 92% of Americans often have been intimidated into what we call climate silence. They won't talk about it. It's actually joined sex, religion, and politics as a taboo subject at the Thanksgiving Day table. Don't talk about climate change because you don't want to piss off Uncle Bob. And it's usually an Uncle Bob. So it's just to say that there's actually a huge majority of the public that's willing to have a constructive conversation about climate, but so far have been restrained by that very small minority at 8%.
How reflective are those categories of the kinds of divisions we might see in other democracies?
They are similar. We've used the same technique across 31 different countries and territories, and we do find the representatives of these groups pretty much everywhere. But I will in particular point to those last two, those doubtful and dismissive. They really don't exist in most countries in the world as a sizable proportion. And in fact, we only find organized climate denial in really four countries: the United States, Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Okay? You don't find an organized denial movement in India or in China or in all of Central and South America or et cetera.
Why is that?
So there's a number of things. One is, of course, the existence of fossil fuel industries. So don't forget that. Oil, coal, and gas, very wealthy institutions, and they have been very actively and with a very sophisticated misinformation campaign that's been waged for over a generation now. So you can't ignore that. But the other we think is an underlying value system. This goes deeper than being Democrat or Republican or liberal or conservative to an underlying worldview about the role of government in society. So on the one hand, you've got one group that's what we call egalitarians. These are people who think there's too much discrimination in society, that inequities of wealth cause major conflict within and across countries, et cetera. Those are the people who are the most concerned about climate change because they're deeply concerned, even if they don't see it as a personal risk yet, they're very worried about the harms it's already or going to have on other people, other species around the world. So those egalitarians are more in that alarmed category. But by contrast to that is a value system we call radical individualism, which is really about individual liberty, individual freedom, autonomy. And we all know this because it's often framed as anti-government. It's too big, too intrusive, too much taxation, too much regulation. We know this discourse very well in the United States. Those people are the most hostile or the most dismissive of climate change, mostly because they see climate change as a threat. Not climate change, the phenomenon. They don't accept that it's even real. But what they find as a threat is that it's going to take coordinated government response to deal with it. And they already have a worldview which says government, well, in the famous words of Grover Norquist, I want to shrink government to the size that I can drown it in a bathtub. If that's your worldview, then of course climate change is going to be a threat, because there's no way that as individuals we can solve a problem like this. It requires coordinated action at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, and yes, at the global level. That's why the COP is being held, is to coordinate action across all the countries of the world, which of course is what the United Nations is about. But as soon as you say United Nations to some parts of American society, they get these visions of black helicopters in their head. And again, it evokes these conspiracy theories that the UN is trying to take away our sovereignty as a country. So anyways, just to say that that underlying value system coupled with the profit seeking of the fossil fuel industry, it's like putting nitrogen and glycerin together. You put them together, you got TNT.
And so even, for example, the Gulf states don't have the same kind of opposition or backlash to the idea of climate change and mitigation efforts.
Because what they're missing is that radical individualism piece. They absolutely have the piece that they're like, no, we want to sell more fossil fuels, of course. The Saudis definitely want to keep selling fossil fuels. And many other people want to keep selling fossil fuels because that's the fundamental basis of their entire economy. So yes, you will find that there, but you don't find organized climate denial, at least in the population.
When it comes to mitigation efforts, that's a lot of what is being discussed at COP26. What are the most and least popular responses to climate change for the majority of the globe and even vast majority of Americans who believe that climate change is real and present?
So even despite our gridlock in this country, and it does seem in many ways intractable at this point, we actually find there is consensus already among Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, across some of the major policies. And let's just take a step back to recognize that the big challenge of climate change is basically moving from a 19th century energy system, which involves still digging stuff up out of the ground and setting it on fire to produce our energy, to moving to a 21st century system, which now harnesses the energy that is swirling around us at all times, from the sun, in the wind, in the tides, in the heat beneath our feet, etc. Okay, that is really the critical transition that needs to happen. And there's some land use stuff that also is vital too, but really the bulk of the problem is that energy transition. And what we see here in the United States and around the world is that there's overwhelming public support for making that transition, overwhelming public support for clean, renewable energy. And I'm talking about even conservative Republicans. I mean, funding more research into renewable energy sources such as solar and wind, you got 59% of conservatives who support that. And people want to be part of it themselves, like, you know, tax rebates and so on to encourage homeowners to buy more energy efficient appliances or cars or solar panels, wildly popular across the political spectrum. But where you start to lose conservatives, and I'll just say that liberal moderate Republicans, you'll find majority support almost across the board. So it's really conservative Republicans who are quite different than everyone else in this country. But as soon as you start talking about government regulations or government taxes, things like that, or governments telling companies what they can and cannot do, there we go back to that underlying value system I was just talking about, that they really don't like that. You get the support really drops off quite dramatically as soon as you start talking about government action and government enforcement of pollution reduction.
What are the other areas where we see pushback? Because understanding that essentially climate scientists have suggested that we need to reduce our carbon emissions by 45% by 2030 in order to keep warming levels at 1.5 degrees Celsius. And even then, they're not quite sure. That suggests really dramatic intervention into society, especially in developed countries where we produce the most emissions. What kinds of interventions would that require? And are those actually popular?
So also great question. And it's the kind of an answer to that has changed dramatically over the past decade. And what really has changed from now, say, from when we last had this big discussion about climate policy back in 2009 with the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill that was tried to be passed in the early days of the Obama administration, is that what's happened in that 10 years is that the price of clean, renewable energy has dramatically dropped. Back then, clean renewable energy like solar and wind power was more expensive than fossil fuels. That's no longer true. Solar and wind and others are now already today cheaper than fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas in many parts of the world, and they're only getting cheaper. That is a radically different socio-political environment today than we had even 10 years ago. And what that entails is that suddenly consumers are seeing that not only are these solutions better for the climate and better for people's health, because, of course, burning fossil fuels produces enormous pollutants that aren't even about climate change. It's just air quality. Like a lot of people die every year from just simple burning of fossil fuels. But now you can get a vehicle, for example, like an electric car that is already starting to penetrate to become a large-scale market. And in fact, that's one of the big announcements at the COP is that seven of the world's major auto industries have said they will be 100% electric cars by the year 2035. This is coming fast. And it's not just simply because we need to do it for climate reasons. It's because you're going to get a car that actually costs less, because you got to include maintenance costs. Don't forget that. Does more. And if you've ever driven an electric car, they are fun to drive. The acceleration's insane.
So what are the main inhibitors today to countries, the United States and abroad, to being more proactive on climate change?
Well, I mean, it always comes down to money, right? And there's a lot of competing demands for national resources. And so in the end, this is about political will to do what's necessary to move quickly. And you've got, again, legacy industries like the fossil fuel industry that are absolutely there. They have been at every single COP in force, trying to slow down, to stop, to weaken, to dilute any policies that that are accepted at the international level, at the national level, at the local level. So those are the kinds of barriers that are always there and are, you know, I think we're starting to see some serious movement. I mean, there's serious discussion, for instance, at this latest international summit in Glasgow about actually saying we're going to commit to phasing out fossil fuels. So anyway, it's just to say these are really complex political challenges in the end, is how do you get leaders who may only be in office for the next 2 to 4 years to commit to actions that are that they, in many cases, won't be alive for. So we'll just use Prime Minister Modi of India as an example. He made a big news announcement that India will be to what's called net zero. In other words, won't be emitting any more carbon pollution than it absorbs through, say, natural processes like trees by the year 2070. That's actually a huge advance. It's a huge promise for a massive developing country like India. But it's 2070. Like, that's 50 years from now. My 18-year-old son will be retired by then. So I'm just saying that Modi will not be around in the year 2070 to make sure that he's delivered on that promise. So in the end, all of these pledges, all these promises that you're seeing coming out of these big meetings ultimately come back to where we started in this conversation. It's all about the politics and the economics and the culture and the will within each individual country. These big international summits are important for coordinating action, but in the end, it all has to happen within every single country of the world.
And so understanding that domestic pressure is really the thing that these leaders are responding to, what would increase domestic pressure that politicians feel about climate change?
So look, this is the question of what influences political decisions, right? And there are, you know, broad things here. So like lobbying influences elected officials, campaigns and elections can influence elected officials. I would say that one of the missing pieces, though, has been a powerful, organized issue public, as we talked about before. A citizens movement who are active and raising their voices collectively and saying, we demand that you act. We are watching your decisions. We will hold you accountable in the next election. We will hold your party accountable in the next election. And that's what I think we started to see really taking off around the world. And it's not just within each individual country. Because of our new communication platforms that are now global, we're seeing that movement actually not just at national and local levels, but as an international movement as well. That movement is getting smarter and smarter and figuring out how to organize for political power. That, I think, has been a missing ingredient in shaping political decisions up to this point.
All right, let's leave it there. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Galen. It's great to be with you.
Anthony Leiserwitz is the director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. My name is Galen Druk. Claire Bittigieri-Curtis is in the control room and on audio editing, and Emma Riley is our intern. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.